This meeting of House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:23 p.m. on Wednesday, March 11th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 20. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Representative Costello, Representative Mina, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. We are also, I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have four items of business on today's agenda. Before I state the items on today's agenda, I will let the public know that we have floor sessions starting in 20 minutes, so we will be going at ease for floor and then coming back to judiciary afterwards. We have four items of business. Number one, House Judiciary Committee Resolution 43 on voter privacy. House Bill 211, insurance prepaid legal plans by Representative Jimmy, will be taking up amendments. House Bill 222, workplace violence protective orders by Representative Hall, that will be its first hearing. And then HJR 31, constitutional amendment, corporation and rights by Representative Fields. Our first item of business is HJR 43, voter privacy. At this time, I would like to invite Sean Mills, House Majority Staff and Counsel, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the committee. My name is Sean Mills. I am House Majority Staff and Counsel. I'm here today solely to present House Joint Resolution number 43. I'm going to give a sparing background and then proceed with the recital if that's the will of the committee.
That's the will of the committee.
So given our time, the background is well known to this committee. This respects the Department of Justice request of the state of Alaska to provide its complete voter registration lists and the ultimate accedance of the state of Alaska to that through a memorandum of understanding. Since the story broke, concerned constituents have contacted caucus members, and we've seen hearings in this body, this committee, as well as in the other body's parallel committee. The purpose of this resolution is threefold, and you see it at the front of the resolution. This resolution affirms the Alaska State Legislature's commitment to voter privacy, election integrity, and the right to vote. It expresses concern regarding the disclosure of confidential information to the United States Department of Justice, and lastly, it urges action to protect voters of the state of Alaska, and specifically it calls upon the Division of Elections. With that brief background, I'd like to proceed with the recital of the resolution itself.
Sure.
Affirming the Alaska State Legislature's commitment to voter privacy, election integrity, and the right to vote, expressing concern regarding disclosure of confidential voter information to the United States Department of Justice, and urging action to protect voters in the state. Be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Alaska, whereas voters in the state have a reasonable expectation that confidential personal information will be protected by state law and used only for legitimate election administration purposes. And whereas Article 1, Section 22 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska enumerates the right of privacy and affirms that the right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. And whereas Article 1, Section 4 of the United States Constitution grants state legislatures authority over the times, places, and manner of federal elections, establishing state sovereignty over electoral processes. And whereas Alaska Statute 1507-195 establishes that the following voter registration information is confidential under state law: date of birth, social security number or any part of that number, driver's license number, voter identification number, place of birth, voter signature, and residential address. If the voter elects to make the voter residential's address confidential. And whereas Alaska Statute 1507195 subsection C1 permits disclosure of confidential voter information to federal agencies only when the disclosure is in compliance with federal law and the receiving federal agency uses the information only for governmental purposes authorized under law. Whereas in July 2025, the United States Department of Justice sent the state a letter claiming the state had more registered active voters than citizens of voting age and demanded the state's complete statewide voter registration list. And whereas the state initially responded by providing only the publicly available voter list. Whereas in August 2025, the United States Department of Justice demanded the state's complete and unredacted voter registration list, including confidential information, and asserted that state privacy laws were clearly preempted by federal law. Whereas in December 2025, the state transmitted its complete voter registration list, including all confidential personal information, to the United States Department of Justice under a memorandum of understanding. Whereas the confidential personal information of approximately 570,000 registered voters in the state has been transmitted to federal authorities and cannot be retrieved. Whereas, as of February 2026, three federal district courts in California, Oregon, and Michigan have substantively ruled on the legal authority of the United States Department of Justice to demand unredacted state voter registration lists, and all three courts rejected the United States Department of Justice claims. Whereas no federal court has ruled in favor of the United States Department of Justice interpretation of federal law in these circumstances, whereas the state has no mechanism to monitor how the United States Department of Justice is using the state's voter data, no ability to limit the Department of Justice's use of the data, and no means to retrieve the transmitted data. Whereas the Alaska State Legislature has received no assurance from federal authorities that the state voter data will not be used for immigration enforcement, criminal investigations, or other purposes unrelated to voter roll maintenance. Whereas the state's unique geography, large Alaska Native population, significant military presence, population of senior citizens born before modern vital record systems were implemented, and a high proportion of residents who live in places that are not on the road system creates specific vulnerabilities to the misuse of personal information and documentation-based barriers to voter registration. Whereas the federal possession of state voters' confidential personal information creates heightened risk that could lead to residents of the state who are eligible to vote being challenged, investigated, or deterred from voting. And whereas election integrity requires both preventing unauthorized voting and protecting every eligible United States citizen's right to vote. Whereas the Constitution of the State of Alaska establishes the Alaska State Legislature's duty to protect the privacy rights of the state's residents and ensure the integrity of the state's electoral processes. And finally, whereas sovereignty over the state's election system is a core state function that should not be compromised by federal overreach. Therefore, be it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature affirms that the privacy of state voters' confidential personal information is a matter of state rights and that the state's voter confidentiality statutes reflect a considered legislative judgment that personal data may not be used for purposes beyond lawful election administration. And be it further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature expresses serious concern that the state voter data transmitted to the United States Department of Justice may be used for purposes beyond voter roll maintenance, including purposes that federal courts have found to be outside of congressional authorization, and that the state has no mechanism to monitor the use of, limit the use of, or retrieve the transmitted data. Be it further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature urges the Division of Elections to immediately request in writing from the United States Department of Justice a detailed accounting of the following: how state voter data is being stored and for how long, who has access to state voter data and whether any other federal agencies have been granted access, what state voter data has been used for and what it will be used for, whether state voter data has been or will be cross-referenced with non-election databases, what safeguards are in place to prevent unauthorized access or misuse, and when state voter data will be destroyed. Further resolved that the Division of Elections, that if the Division of Elections receives a response from the U.S. Department of Justice, the Alaska State Legislature urges the Division of Elections to transmit that response to the presiding officer of each house of the Alaska State Legislature within 30 days after receipt. Be it further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature commits to monitoring the implementation of any federal voter registration requirements to ensure that no eligible resident is disenfranchised by citizenship documentation barriers, with particular attention to 1. Alaska Native communities where birth records may be incomplete or inaccessible. 2. Rural residents and residents living off of the road system who face unique challenges obtaining documentary proof of United States citizenship. 3. Alaska Native elders and senior citizens born before modern vital record systems. 4. Active duty military personnel and families of active duty military personnel who may have been born outside the state. 5. Naturalized citizens who have established lives in the state. And 6. Any state resident whose voter registration status is challenged based on the information contained in the voter data transmitted to federal authorities. Be it further resolved that this resolution expresses the will of the Alaska State Legislature and is intended to provide guidance to state agencies, federal authorities, and the public regarding legislative priorities and intentions for protecting state voter privacy and election integrity. Copies of the resolution shall be sent to the Honorable Pamela Bondi, Attorney General of the United States, the Honorable Harmeet K. Dillon, Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, the Honorable Mike Dunleavy, Governor of Alaska, the Honorable Nancy Dahlstrom, Lieutenant Governor, the Honorable Stephen Cox, Attorney General, Carol Beecher, Director of Elections, and the Honorable Lisa Murkowski, the Honorable Dan Sullivan, and the Honorable Nicholas Begich, our congressional delegation. And with that, that ends the recital of the resolution. Chair Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. We have 3 minutes for any questions or comments at this time. Does anyone from the committee have any questions or comments at this time about Resolution 43? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand the desire to bring this forward. And I have a lot of agreement, but I have a lot of opposition to certain things. But I will focus on one area right now. And on page 2, it mentions approximately 570,000 registered voters in the state. Mm-hmm. Their information was transmitted. I would like to respectfully challenge that number is actually 608,400. And I know that because I requested from the division the exact list that they sent to the DOJ and has looked at that number. And I would also like to indicate that the division director last week in committee, when asked how many Alaskan voters were on the voter rolls that were sent, it was approximately 550,000. But the actual list that was sent was 608,400. I have significant questions about the discrepancies in the actual numbers and what is being spoken of on the list. So I believe that that is one important correction that needs to be made. But I would like us to discuss some of the technical language. I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but I would like, if we're going to pursue this, get more information on from the Department of Administration, who had worked through the Real ID, where we heard about many Alaska Native elders who did not have birth certificates. I would like to find out what they did to resolve that, but also how many are we talking about? And they've had access to voting currently because of an attestation that they are a U.S. citizenship or a citizen. So if there's actual data on that number, that would be helpful too.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I think we can make that change, and we can get Department of Administration to answer those questions. Any other questions or comments? Representative Costello.
Thank you. And I share the same concerns as my colleague. I was curious to know, I know that as a legislator, I can purchase voter data for my district, newly registered voters. I'd like to know what information is all included in that list that is accessible to the public, I think for $20. And then I had a question, because I was thinking about this. Where are our Social Security numbers kept at the federal level? What department and what security methods are used to keep our Social Security numbers confidential? On page 3, line 1, there's a section that says we have not received any assurance, or we've received no assurance that the state voter data will not be used. And what form will that assurance come in? What are we hoping to gain by having that? I mean, what form would that assurance look like? And then finally, when we travel, we actually present our driver's licenses to get through TSA. Could we find out what happens with that information? And I know it says right there that it's not kept. However, I would like to know more information about the driver's licenses, because all of these are federal administrations, federal departments. You know, we pay our taxes, we have our Social Security numbers, our driver's licenses are used when we travel. So could we get some information on what happens with all of that information and who keeps it?
Yes, we can. And I'll just remind from the initial hearing that we had, we did have a lot of discussion about the public list, which was shared with DOJ in August, and then getting the feedback that that was not sufficient. And so then, but we'll spell it out in a handout exactly what was shared publicly, which is available for $20, and then with all fields visible, as was shared in December, which included the confidential information, specifically the driver's license numbers and everyone's residential address, even if you'd marked to please not share it. I think those are like the two biggies that were shared, that were not shared in August. I think, yes, Representative Kopp.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Mr. Chairman, commend legal counsel on the excellent job of coming forth with a nonpartisan resolution speaking directly to the issue that Alaskans care about so deeply. That I know that could not have been easy crafting it that way, but I see that throughout, very well written and speaking directly to the privacy concerns that I think 90% of our constituents share. So thank you for that.
I'll echo Vice Chair Kopp's compliments. Thank you for your work today, and thanks for your presentation, Mr. Mills. And we will go at ease until after floor session. At ease. At ease. Wonderful. back on the record, we were talking about HJR 43 voter privacy. We had some questions from committee that we're going to need to get some folks to come and answer those questions. Before we put HJR 43 aside, are there any other folks that we should contact to be available to answer questions the next time we bring this resolution forward? We will be reaching out to the Social Security Administration. We'll be reaching out to TSA. That's what I have from before the break. Are there any other organizations that we should reach out to? I'm asking the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
For clarification, I don't know. Potentially, TSA, I know that the Department of Administration had worked on the whole issue around real IDs. They may have some relevant information. Mm-hmm.
So
concerning,
if I hear what you're saying, Representative Vance, Department of Administration may be able to answer these questions, and we may not need to go directly to the federal organization.
Agreed. A few years ago, when there was a consolidation attempt to consolidate some DMV offices, and also at the same time implement the Real ID in Alaska, there was a lot of concerns and pushback about Alaska Native elders not having a formal birth certificate, and also addresses. So I would like an update on how many elders that we are looking at, and if they have had some way to resolve proving that they are in fact a U.S. citizen, because that is one of the concerns here. And I'm hoping that the work that was previously done, they have some account so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Thank you, Representative Vance. We will have Department of Administration present the next time we take up HJR 43 to give us an update. And based on how that goes, we'll decide if we need to contact any federal administrations directly. And we will not set an amendment deadline at this time until after we've spoken with Department of Administration. Does anyone have any questions or comments before we set HJR 43 aside today? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Mills. We will set HJR 43 aside and bring it up at a later date. At that time, we will also have public comment. We now move on to our second item, HB 211, Insurance Prepaid Legal Plans. We will not do that. At ease. We don't have anyone. Back on the record. We will now call up Representative Jimmy's staff, Keenan Miller. Welcome. If you could put yourself on the record and maybe just a couple of sentences reminding us what HB 211 does.
Yeah, totally. And forgive me if I'm short of breath. I just ran down the stairs. Hello, my name is Keenan Miller, for the record. As a quick reminder for the committee, this bill makes prepaid legal plans easier to access by removing insurance sales requirements, exempting them from regulation as an insurance product. I feel like that mostly covers it, so I will go ahead and be quiet now.
Thank you. I would like to note that we have Assistant Attorney General Ian Engelbeck from the Consumer Protection Division on the line to answer questions. We also have Heather Carpenter from the Division of Insurance in the room. We had an amendment deadline. That amendment deadline was reached. We have one amendment. I will move Amendment 2.
I will object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you. I would now like to invite my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, to come forward, put himself on the record, and explain Amendment 2.
Good afternoon, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, committee aide. So Amendment 2, which is co-sponsored here by Chair Gray and Representative Vance, is to ensure that adequate consumer protection measures are in place for prepaid legal plans. As Mr. Miller explained, the purpose of the bill is to define prepaid legal plans as not an insurance product, which means they would not be regulated by the Division of Insurance. So what Amendment 2 does is it creates some specific disclosure requirements, setting minimum standards of information that prepaid legal plans have to provide to consumers. And it says that the failure to do so is an unfair trade practice. And this brings prepaid legal plans, like almost all, you know, non-insurance business, within the ambit of the Consumer Protection Unit of the Attorney General's office. As Chair Gray said, Ian Engelbeck is on the line to answer any technical questions regarding consumer protection. But I could give any a more detailed analysis of the amendment, but that is the overarching gist of it. I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee? Seeing no questions from committee, is the objection maintained?
I remove my objection.
Seeing no further objection, Amendment 2 has been adopted. Are there any other questions or comments about HB 211 for the sponsor? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 211, Work Order 34-LS0848/A, move from the House Judiciary Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 211, Work Order 34-LS0848/A as an alpha, moves from the House Judiciary Committee as amended. With individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. Thank you so much, Mr. Miller. We will now take an at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. Back on the record, I'd like to note that we were joined by Representative Chuck Kopp at 1:27 p.m. Our next item of business is House Bill 222. I get the eddies. For the record, I'd also like to note that we're joined by Representative Underwood at 3:21 p.m. Our next item of business is House Bill 222, Workplace Violence Protective Orders, sponsored by Representative Hall. At this time, I would like to invite her staff, Keith Bruce, to the witness table. Mr. Bruce, please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Thank you, Chair Gray and the Judiciary Committee. Representative Hall may join me after I start going on with these remarks. For the record, my name is Keith Bruce, staff to Representative Hall. With permission of the chair, I'll read our opening remarks.
Please proceed.
Thank you for hearing House Bill 222 today. Every year in Alaska, a domestic violence shelter will have to deal with one of the scariest situations possible. Someone, often the respondent in a domestic violence case, will commit an act of violence or make credible threats of violence against the shelter staff and the workplace. Sometimes it's a shooting threat, sometimes it's a bomb threat, other times a person may forcibly enter the shelter. Though there may only be a handful of these incidents in a given year, they leave staff traumatized and make it difficult for shelters to deliver support to shelter residents. Despite the severity of these incidents I just described, shelter operators lacked the legal tools to adequately protect workers and their premises. Trespassing restrictions provide temporary relief, but cannot keep a perpetrator from intimidating employees just outside property lines, as is so often the case in rural shelters. Temporary restraining orders often take several days to complete and often cost thousands of dollars. In contrast, people seeking a domestic violence protective order can usually get a court order within one day. House Bill 222 would allow an employer to file a petition for a protective order against an individual under two circumstances. First, an individual has committed an act of violence against an employer or an employee at the workplace. And second, an individual made a threat of violence against the employer or employee that may be carried out at the workplace. A violation of the provisions of the protective order would be a crime of violating a protective order, which is a Class A misdemeanor. House Bill 222 would also prohibit attorney fee awards against a petitioner in domestic violence restraining order proceedings, stalking, and sexual assault protective orders, and ex parte protective orders. This bill is not a novel idea. To date, 11 states have laws providing for the issuance of protective or restraining orders that are specific to workplace violence. Utah is the most recent addition to this list, which passed a workplace protective order law in 2023. HB 222's companion legislation, SB 49, sponsored by the senator from District H, was written over several years with close collaboration from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. While workplace protective orders may raise questions over victim autonomy in the protective order process, I know the senator's office worked hard on ensuring that this legislation provides employers with a more effective way to protect their workplace without reaching into the personal lives of their employees. With permission of the chair, we'll read the sectional analysis now, too.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce, and welcome to bill sponsor, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your patience and indulgence with competing schedules that we've had due to the extended floor session today.
Mr. Bruce, please read the sectional analysis.
Section 1 amends AS 1156-740A by adding a new subsection 4 to specify that a person commits the crime of violating a protective order if the person knowingly commits or attempts to commit an act that violates the provisions listed under the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes. Section 2 amends AS 1156-740C by adding the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes to the meaning of protective order. Section 3 amends AS 1326-460 to prohibit attorney fees awarded against petitioners in ex parte protective orders. Sections 4 through 6 amends AS 1865 to align the procedure for workplace violence protective orders with the procedure for other protective orders. Section 7 amends AS 1865-865 to prohibit attorney fees awarded against the petitioner in stalking and sexual assault protective orders. Section 8 amends AS 1865 to add a new section, Article 12A, Workplace Violence Protective Orders. Particularly, Section 1865-875A gives employers the ability to file a petition for a protective order against an individual who the employer reasonably believes committed an act of violence against the employer or employee at the workplace, or makes a credible threat of violence against the employer or employee that can be reasonably construed as a threat that may be carried out at the workplace. Section 9 amends 1866-150 to prohibit attorney fees awarded against petitioners in domestic violence restraining order proceedings. Sections 10 through 12 relates to the powers of district judges and magistrates, as well as indirect court rule amendments. And Section 13 provides the effective date. That concludes my sectional analysis.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the sponsor or staff about House Bill 222? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have to be the first one to ask questions all the time, because I will always have questions. But here we are. I appreciate you bringing this forward. This is not the first time we've seen this. It's a very necessary piece of legislation. But I was wondering what consultation have there been with some of the tribal organizations in being able to do protective orders? And I know that there's been previous work done so that they can work in partnership with Department of Public Safety. Have you had any conversations about that and the impact this bill would make on some of their requests?
Thank you, Representative Vance, Chair Gray. Through the chair, Representative Vance, I personally have not. I defer to my staff as far as whether he has, but I do believe we have Ms. Brenda Stanfill here in the audience who's done extensive work in the background and can provide some additional insight that I am unable to at this time.
Ms. Stanfill?
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Vance.
Put yourself on the record, please.
This is Brenda Stanfill with a sorry, I came up the hill rather fast. the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Could you repeat the question?
Thank you. It'll give you an opportunity to catch your breath, too. I completely understand. So I know that there has been tribal organizations that are wanting to have protective orders, and you might have to rejog my memory if we're talking about a similar thing. And they've been working in partnership with Department of Public Safety to have those recognized. What's an updated conversation of how this bill may impact some of their requests for protective orders?
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Vance, currently the tribes set their own standards and mandates of how they'll issue tribal orders. Full faith and credit means that as a state of Alaska, we recognize those tribal orders. Most of the time, those tribal orders are set up to be a domestic violence protective order, family violence protective order, but they could expand those to what they wanted to within their tribal jurisdiction. This would not impact what they are required to do. If they wanted to do something similar, and then we would most likely need to look at the state in the recognition part of it, but it should still fall under the full faith and credit. But we can do some more research on that just to make sure. You had also asked if there had been outreach to the tribes, and I will say we have not done outreach to the tribes, and I don't believe that there has been outreach to the tribes at this time.
Follow up? I appreciate your insight and being able to give information on this. I know that there are tribal organizations And, you know, there are a lot of people, members of tribes who are, you know, participating in shelters. And remember that the conversation around needing this is primarily focused around the shelter. So I'm just trying to get all encompassing information of to make sure that we're not neglecting that aspect of it for workplace, and any other helpful information you have as far as the impact of that, of what this specifically is to the to those types of needs with the shelters, is also helpful for the committee.
Through the chair to Representative Vance. So all of our current shelter programs are covered under a nonprofit organization. So even our organization that is Hooper Bay, that is a combination of three tribal organizations coming together, actually they go under rural cap. So they're still considered to be a nonprofit. Emonic, who works closely with their tribe, is still set up as a nonprofit. So right now this would cover our general shelters. But we also have tribal organizations, tribal governments, not tribal organizations, but tribal governments that have OVC money, Office of Victims of Crime money, that are working with potential victims that may have a person who's dangerous on the other side of it. We're having to work out some of the details. It's gotten complicated. So I'll take I'll meet with you afterwards or in the next few days to talk about that more. But right now, this would not cover the tribal government, I don't believe.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question for the sponsor. Can you give some examples specific of when this workplace order, protective order, would be used, and how we don't have like domestic violence protective order or a stalking protective order, the other types of protective orders that we currently have in statute wouldn't work? Like I guess some specific examples of why we need this law.
Sure. Thank you very much for that question, Chair Gray. I can offer an anecdotal experience has been relayed to me, but I would also like to hear from Ms. Stanfield because okay. It is her bailiwick and her organization has more direct experiences than I do. But my understanding is that when there is an imminent threat or there has been an actual act of harm that has occurred at a workplace such as a shelter, then what this workplace violence protective order would do is allow the workplace to expeditiously request a workplace protective order that would basically be able to be implemented much more fast than a regular protective order or another kind of protective order where that takes a longer period of time to actually be issued and in place. So I'm not explaining it very well, but essentially the bill is modeled off of existing protective order statutes, and the process and restrictions are largely the same as a protective order for sexual harassment or sexual assault or harassment. If the danger is not immediate, an employer can file a protective order request with a local court, and hearing will be scheduled, but the accused has an opportunity to oppose the order. If the court finds by a preponderance of evidence that the respondent has committed violence or made a threat of violence, the court may order relief and issue a protective order effective for 6 months. That's how it's outlined in the bill. This is shorter than other protective orders that last a year. So the bill is really tailored for this kind of workplace violence. And I should probably just stop, just really hand it over to the expert.
Sure. Ms. Stanfield.
Say it a lot better than I can.
Yes, there was, when this bill started, this is the second session. And at the very beginning, a constituent had come to someone and had said, you know, this thing happened in my workplace and we let someone go. They had done something harmful. There would most likely be a civil proceeding on there. But there had been threats made as the person left. And when they tried to get some type of protective order, they found out there's only three kinds. There's one for domestic violence, which requires the relationship. There was one for sexual assault that requires a sexual assault to have occurred. And then there's one for stalking, where you have to meet the elements of a stalking crime. So a one-time threat of violence does not rise to the level of any of those if you don't have the relationship. And so they found they could not, and they had to go file a civil court case, and then they had to get a hearing, and then they could get a no contact order through that, but that would take anywhere from 2 weeks to a month. So that was the impetus for this bill, from my understanding. And then when this bill started moving and we talked to our membership said, oh my gosh, that would help us so much, because right now we have people who stand right outside of our fence line and they stare at us. Sometimes they make gun shooting motions. Sometimes they just, in certain communities, rural areas, some people walk to work and they've followed them in certain areas. And so they said this would help so much that we could go and say, as an organization, we are in danger. Oftentimes they're in danger and the person thinks is staying there isn't even there. And so it's not like the person can go get a protective order who's the actual victim, if you want to look at it that way, because they're not even staying in the shelter, but the person thinks they are. So he's harassing, intimidating, trying to do what he can do to threaten the staff. So that's how the shelter programs came into saying this would be really, really helpful, because right now there is no way for a program to protect themselves or a workplace to protect themselves. They can do a trespass order, but all that does is keeps them off of your property. As long as they're 1 inch off your property, they're still within the law and have a right to be there.
Thank you. I appreciate that answer. And I know that Rep. Mina's in my queue. I want to ask another question. I'd like to ask it to Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the courts.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. I just want to check and make sure, as I read the bill, about the two criteria to become eligible for a workplace protective order. You've either committed an act of violence against the employer or an employee that occurred at the employer's workplace, or made a threat of violence against the employer or employee that can be really reasonably construed as a threat that may be carried out at the employer's workplace. I'm just curious. In my mind, I think, like, you have a coworker that you work next to. You make that coworker angry. They say, like, I'm going to kill you. Would that, and then, like, say that the person's like, oh, well, I'm going to take out a workplace protective order. I'm just kind of thinking about unintended consequences. Like, if you have coworkers taking out workplace protective orders against each other as a form of sort of like workplace, inner workplace dynamic harassment, would this bill allow for that?
To the chair, I actually have not thought about that scenario, to be honest. But your point is well taken. Obviously the intent is for the employer to be able to take out an order to protect the employee and others in the workplace. I think I would need more time to think about that scenario before I shoot from the hip. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'll follow up with one question to you. Just as your understanding of the bill and what the bill is intended, are there any possible unintended consequences? I don't know if you could say that. Like, I was thinking about coworkers, but it seems like it might be easy to get a workplace protective order against somebody who makes a one-time threat in anger. Am I misreading the language that a 6-month protective order could be taken against somebody for saying, I'm going to kill you at work? And that might...
To the chair, without meaning to interrupt, but as I read sub A there, and I'm on page 3, lines 19 and 20, so there has to have been actual violence. For example, an employee was punched or assaulted, and then the employer can get a protective order against the assaulter to say, stay away from this workplace. I'm afraid you're going to do that here and cause problems for me and my other employees. And as I read lines 21 through 23, if somebody makes a threat against you or your employee, and if it's reasonably construed to be carried out there, you know, if somebody says, I'm going to come back and shoot up the establishment or something like that, I think that's what this is aimed for. Now, could you get it? Could a judge grant it if somebody makes one off-the-cuff remark? I think possibly, but I think the judge's job is to discern whether that's a reasonable reason to give a protective order or if that was just an off-the-cuff remark and there really is no necessity to issue that.
Thank you. Representative Mina and then Representative Costello.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, this is for Ms. Mead, and I'm new to this bill and also learning about the civil protective orders. So I just want to clarify, my understanding is that this bill would create a new type of protective order on top of the existing civil protective orders for domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And I know that there's also the differences in terms of the duration. And so is this bill only specific to the ex parte protective orders, or does it create both the emergency ex parte and the long-term protective orders for workplaces?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, this parallels, and just as an aside, there's also a financial abuse protective order if somebody suspects that an elderly or vulnerable person might be taken advantage of financially. But we're not talking about that. This bill, starting in Section 8, it parallels and is very similar to the provisions for all three of the other types of protective orders. The provision starting on page 3, line 16, just protective orders, those are what we call the long-term protective orders. And then you can see on line 30 that here they're for 6 months. That's the length of a long-term protective order for workplace violence. In domestic violence, it's 1 year. So this is slightly different in that regard. And then if you flip to page 4, line 23, the ex parte, that is exactly like the process, or similar to the process for a domestic violence or stalking or sexual assault protective order. That's where you go in, and at the hearing, the other party is not present. So there's only one person there. And if granted, that one is, of course, shorter because the other person hasn't had due process yet. So that is a 20-day order, and that's the same as it is for domestic violence. The rest of Section 8 goes on with several other statutes that mirror the domestic violence statutes for protective orders.
Thank you. Follow up? Through the chair to Ms. Mead. So in the status quo, what actions or laws can businesses take if you have the example of an individual who might be like right on the outskirts of an individual's civil protective order? And I'm thinking like more broadly, I know the sponsor statement references enacting in a civil lawsuit, but you know, nuisance laws, et cetera, what other laws could a business do?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, I think as Ms. Stanfill referenced, people could call the police and try to get the person arrested for trespass. That, of course, would not be available if the person's on public property, for example, on a sidewalk outside of private property. But if they're on private property, they could be trespassed. If the person outside has a protective order in place and the petitioner is inside the facility, for example, if somebody at a shelter has a protective order and the respondent in that protective order is outside, but within the circumference that they're not allowed to be in with a protective order, because a protective order will often say, stay a half mile away from X address. If they are, well, that's the crime of violating the terms of a protective order for that individual. So that, again, you could call the law enforcement and that person could be arrested for that crime. In fact, it's a mandatory arrest for that crime. So I don't think nuisance law would apply in any of those situations. And if somebody's not subject to a protective order that they're violating, and if they're on public property, I do think there are limited options available.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. And my line of questioning is very similar to Representative Mina. I was curious, so if the person who is stalking essentially is going to the shelter believing that the individual has a restraining order against them is inside, so they're already in the system. Their name is in the system, and they're already violating some kind of the terms of their, you know, the civil protective order. Is that correct?
through the chair to Representative Costello, almost, well, very likely, a protective order often has specific places where the respondent is not allowed to go. And it might say within 100 feet of the petitioner, or might say within a mile of the petitioner. So it would depend. But generally, yes, if there is an active protective order in place, they could be violating that.
Mr. Chair, permission to dialogue? Thank you.
Permission granted.
So if, I mean, obviously when people are stalking somebody, they may go someplace where the person isn't. So I'm just curious if what we're doing here already exists, this protection. One other thing that was brought up by the sponsor staff is that restraining orders cost thousands of dollars. And we had a presentation the other day in this committee, and I was under the impression that you cannot charge for a civil protective order. Am I correct in that?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, you are correct. To my knowledge, there is, well, I know the court does not charge any fee for a protective order. That's absolutely true.
What about the timeline? How long does somebody have to wait usually to get a civil protective order? In this bill, we're calling it a workplace protective order. How long would it take for an employer to get that?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, the court handles petitions for domestic violence, protective order stalking, and all the other protective orders on an emergency basis. The hearing is often within 20 minutes. It can be within an hour. It's virtually immediate, with rare exceptions. It might be a couple of hours.
And it's my understanding from the hearing, the examples, that what's happening here is that, for example, you'll have a shelter and an individual who is in an active, you know, civil protective order situation will go there, and the employees are feeling unsafe. And even if the employer is not there on the property, they are the individual that has to request the restraining order. And if so, how does that happen when they're not experiencing that firsthand? It's secondhand information.
Through the chair to Representative Costello, you are correct that this gives employers the right to do that. So it's defined in the bill, but, you know, a supervisor or something like that. And the employers could come into court and fill out the petition and say, I didn't observe somebody being assaulted on the property, but this is what happened. And, or I didn't hear it myself, but there was a threat and I saw, or people told, my staff told me that somebody was out there making gun shooting motions against people as they went into their car after work. And that was, it's frightening my staff, and we're afraid that that is going to escalate into actual violence that will occur in my parking lot. So that's how I would envision this working.
Do other states have workplace protective orders?
Through the chair, I'm aware of about 10 or 12 that I know of.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Eichheim.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, so just to clarify, just a couple clarifying questions. So this bill applies to protective orders surrounding a specific workplace. So it's geographic based, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
And as a follow-up, so this also applies to public workspaces such as, say, a public library, a state capitol. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. You could apply for a protective order if you believed somebody was threatening your staff in a way or committed violence in a way that you think might be carried out in the Capitol building.
Okay. And one final follow-up. So I assume then based on that, this could also apply to a school against a minor that posed a threat that the workplace deemed was not appropriate for that student to be in that building. Just a clarification on that.
Through the chair to Representative Eichheim, I think your hypothetical is, could a principal ask the court to keep a child out of the school because they're afraid the child may be violent on the grounds. Again, a hypothetical that I had not anticipated. I can't think of now why they could not under the wording of this bill. As in, yes, I think they might be able to under the wording of this bill.
Final comment on that. I just being a former teacher, you know, there are individuals, whether they're parents of children or sometimes the children themselves that are of concern, and the school districts have various methods to deal with that, but sometimes they're lengthy, expulsion, things of that sort, suspension. So just thank you for that.
Thank you. I will go back to my question to Ms. Mead, because now reading the sponsor statement and reading the bill more carefully, my example of two coworkers having a spat wouldn't apply because it has to be applied for by the employer, and only the employer can apply for this workplace protective order. So that's correct, correct?
Only an employer can apply. Now, an employer is a person who employs one or more persons. You could get into scenarios where that might become arguable, but in a straightforward manner, you might think just the supervisor is the employer, but there could be argument about it.
Representative Costello, and then Representative Eichheit, and then Representative Vance.
I really appreciate you giving us flexibility as we think of new questions.
And permission for everyone to dialogue.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Greatly appreciated. So in other states that have this on the books, I imagine we have a track record where we can look back and look at some of the challenges. And what my concern or my question is, if an employee asks an employer to, you know, have an active, you know, civil restraining order, and the employer doesn't take that action, are they going to be liable for any harm that might come to an individual? And then another question is about the interaction in the courts. So we heard just the other day, we learned more about civil protective orders. And I appreciate that hearing, Mr. Chair. And it can oftentimes be this lengthy, involved process where the individual is finding that they have to go back to the courts and they can be amended, and there's all kinds of complexities. So how does the employer address all of that? I mean, is that the same type of interaction that they now are going to have with the courts as if they personally were involved in civil protective order? What is their level of engagement with the courts, and then the fees and all, if there are any, you know, if they retain a lawyer, that type of thing?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, to answer your first question first, there's a provision on page 7, starting at line 25, basically insulating, or I'd say line 29 to your specific question, insulating an employer who fails to seek a protective order from any civil liability. So that is, that takes care of, I think, your concern that if somebody asks for it and the employer doesn't do it, they cannot be held liable in civil court. Your second question is, I'll harken back to the hearing the other day. Protective orders are free to file for. They're 100% free all the time. The vast majority of the time, people come in once. They fill out a petition for, and they can check the box that we provide the petition. I want a short term, the ex parte 20 day, and often they say, and a long term, because why not? And so they get their first hearing right away and make it the short term order issued. They often then either don't appear for the long term hearing, which is why there's such a high denial rate for that, or they appear once more if they want the long term hearing within 20 days. in the vast, vast majority of the cases, that ends their involvement with the court. So they came once to file and get the fast one. They can come back and get the longer term one. The scenarios you were listening to were because somebody wanted to keep it in place. And the specific witness, I think, was talking about by filing that instigated more legal proceedings in a child custody case. So that was a separate and unique scenario. So it's free. It's usually quite simple. And so an employer could do this just for 20 days. And if they want it to last for the 6 months, they would have to come back for a hearing. But then that's all that would happen. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Eichheit and Representative Vance, but I did want to make a comment because I was just had my memory jogged that after the hearing on Monday, I had questions about why so many domestic violence protective orders were denied. And it's my understanding, and Ms. Mead, correct me if I'm wrong, many times it's because the person who is applying for it doesn't actually live in the same house with the person or doesn't actually meet the criteria for a domestic violence protective order. So, for example, an ex-girlfriend who's texting the new girlfriend over and over and over again, and the new girlfriend files for a domestic violence protective order, it doesn't qualify because the new girlfriend and the ex-girlfriend don't meet the criteria of an intimate partner relationship. They don't meet the criteria. So that's why when we saw that graph of so many applied for and only this many granted, it's because many that are applied for don't meet the criteria. Did I state that correctly, Ms. Mead?
To the chair, I think that's quite accurate. Yes, there's a high denial rate, but that's because the statute does require that people be in the particular relationship. They have to be a household member or former roommates or former intimate partner or something. I mean, it's very specifically spelled out. So a lot of people don't know about that restriction and will apply, but are just not eligible because it's not domestic violence. And the second reason there's a high denial rate is you have to show that they're just probable cause, low level, that a crime of domestic violence that has occurred. And sometimes people are displeased with a partner for reasons, but they don't rise to the level of crime. For example, the person is an addict or an alcoholic or something, but that isn't, you don't get a protective order unless a crime of DV has occurred. So those are some of the reasons.
Thank you. I'm going to follow one more follow up from the hearing from Monday. We also heard in that hearing about the domestic violence protective order, you know, occupying a year of time. But you just mentioned it, Ms. Mead. It was custody issues that were requiring a lot of court stuff, that the actual filing for the domestic violence protective order for the additional year is not a process that took up multiple months. I just wanted to, because I think there was some, it was kind of implied that it might be the protective order system that has a problem. But it was actually because there's other issues involving courts that were happening in that hearing that we heard from.
Yes, the statutes are quite, to the chair, the statutes are quite clear on what has to happen in a petition and what an order can do. And it's not terribly complicated. And in fact, the court worked very closely with the advocates and the groups that you see in front of you to ensure that the instructions are very helpful for all protective orders. And this bill would require the court to create forms and instructions as well. And we would follow the example of what we have worked out already to make it simple for people to use.
And I will point of order myself and apologize to the sponsor of the bill. We are back to the bill in question. I have no more corrections from the hearing from Monday. And Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I have two questions. One is this idea of a protective order issued for a threat of violence. And I'm interested in what constitutes, reasonably constitutes a threat of violence. Obviously, verbal statements like "I'm going to kill you" or "I'm going to blow this place up," "shoot this place up," that to me seems very reasonable as a threat of violence. But it was intimated before nonverbal threats of violence. And there's a whole range of things. I mean, balling up your fist. You know, if I'm a law enforcement officer or just a citizen and someone comes up to me, that's a threat of violence, potentially. So I'm curious, what do nonverbal threats of violence, what is this reasonable standard? I do not understand what a reasonable standard is.
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, that is what judges handle all the time. Many statutes say there's a reasonable person standard in negligence, for example, and that would be a judgment call. And, you know, fortunately, the professionals making those calls can listen to the testimony and draw upon their experience and other witnesses, et cetera, and come to a conclusion of whether this was reasonably a threat of violence, or if somebody, as in the example that the chair gave earlier, kind of blurted out something that they were not going to follow through on, but maybe in print it would have looked bad, but they take into account the totality of the circumstances and make that call in deciding whether it amounts to what the statute would require.
I appreciate that. And just a follow-up, then another hypothetical, and I'm sorry to ask hypotheticals, but they are informative. Let's go back to that public school situation, because that's my professional experience. You know, and this goes back to the chair's question about coworkers. Coworkers sometimes don't get along. In an education setting, most teachers are union employees with contractual due process rights once they get through probation. The scenario I envision is two tenured teachers, continuing contract teachers. They have a dispute, and one says something inappropriate along the lines, you know, like, "I wish you were dead," or "I'm going to kill you." Clearly inappropriate, violent things that should be dealt with. The recipient of that threat goes to the supervisor, usually the principal, and says, "I just received this threat," and that's proper. But in this hypothetical, the principal, who doesn't like the person that made the threat, says, "Aha, I can seek a protective order, remove them from this building, and now they can no longer come to the building to teach, and there may not be alternatives." And that seems to be a fast road to being fired. Is that possible under this bill? This kind of, I'm talking about where, you know, people use their supervisory powers, and believe it or not, people do misuse their power, supervisory power, and they will try to do end runs around contracts and due process rights. Is this fear irrational on my part?
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, I don't think it's irrational. Again, I'll point to the high denial rate for other types of protective orders. People do file things that are not appropriate for a court order, and the court has to go through those and figure out if this is reasonable, if there really is a threat, if there really was violence. And so that could happen. I mean, if this statute exists, the person could fill out the form, and then there would be the ex parte hearing, and, you know, hopefully the judge would get to the bottom of it or get to the correct answer and decline to issue the order or issue it if it is called for. But that happens quite often with all sorts of protective orders, because there's no state action. There's no Department of Law. This is just neighbor against neighbor, person against person, intimate partner against intimate partner. So there are sometimes misuses. So that is not an irrational thought.
I appreciate that's very helpful for me. It just, it helps me deal with that fear. So thank you.
I'm Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I now have a whole series of questions. I think what we've embarked on...
Permission to dialogue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what we've embarked on is the question of one person's right to safety and another person's right to employment. So which one takes precedence? I also would like to just make a statement that if we may have to exempt the legislature from this bill, if there's going to be, if we can't make threats of verbal threats of violence, I think most people in this building after today's floor would be guilty. However, I do have some specific questions here. Under the definitions, it has a definition of workplace means a place of employment other than a place used primarily as a residence. And does that mean that people who have their small business out of their home, where they have a couple of employees there, would be exempt from this?
Through the chair to Rep. Vance, if that place was primarily used as a residence, I would read that as saying that couldn't be a workplace under this bill.
So if they were experiencing the threats against their employees, do they have any other type of remedy that they could seek?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, for them, this bill wouldn't apply, so it would be status quo, what they can do today, which is try to get a trespass order. If there's action that amounts to stalking, they could try to get a stalking order. Or if there's a domestic relationship, obviously they could go that route. But this does not apply if that place is used as a residence, as I read it.
Thank you. The other question that I had is the changes that I see with this specific bill versus previous versions is saying that attorney fees may not be awarded against a petitioner. And do you know the background of why this specific language is included? And this may be a question for the bill sponsor, but this very much impacts this is essentially a bill impacting the court. So I'd like to know why we've seen this change.
To the chair, to Representative Vance, my understanding is, though extremely rare, there have been a few cases where courts have awarded attorney's fees to the person trying to get a protective order. For example, if something happened that the court thought, and I know the couple of cases, it's very rare where it happened, is because there was some determination that the petition was not well-founded or needed to be discouraged from further acts like that in the future. And therefore, it was unfair for the respondent to have had to pay an attorney when really the petitioner maybe didn't have enough grounds to really proceed with that. So attorney's fees are designed to equal the playing field, maybe discourage frivolous actions in some cases, and having that in the law is fine in this statute. If the legislature doesn't want those ever to be awarded, the court will, of course, never award them. They are quite, quite, quite rare.
Thank you. I have one final question back to the workplace. Are there any other instances in law that that allows us, for instance, this legislative building, that we could have a workplace protective order? Does someone have a right to access a public building? Does that right supersede, like the House of Representatives, People's House? Does that right supersede a protective order?
To the chair, to Representative Vance, I would conclude not. That generally people can go into a public building, but if there is the specific court order saying a particular individual cannot, that is an effective court order. And sometimes that's done in criminal cases. For example, a trespass case may have as a probation condition, and for the next 4 months, you may not enter other premises. I've never heard that was unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Before we go to Representative Costello, I just wanted... Oh, you're not on the list? Okay. Then I'll just say, in response to Representative Eichscheid's line of questioning, if you turn to page 4 of the bill, lines 9 through 11, I'll just read, the court may order the respondent to stay away from the respondent's own workplace only if the respondent has been provided actual notice of the opportunity to appear and be heard on the petition. Meaning, so in the case where you gave of two teachers who hated each other and the supervisor, the principal, didn't like the teacher who made the threat, that teacher should have the opportunity to say her or his case before they're forbidden from going to their own place of work. Ms. Mead.
To the chair. That is correct. I would just clarify that that appears in the provisions for the long-term order because there's always a hearing before a six-month order goes into effect. The ex parte order, which starts on the next page and or at the bottom of that page, 4, and the ex parte, which again is just 20 days, does say that you can grant anything allowed in C, and then in turn your provision would be, but the stay-away order is only after the hearing. So the chair is correct. Those provisions are read in concert.
Okay. Any more questions for the sponsor? Or, you know, I've gone over my own time limit, but can we have Ms. Stanfield come back up? I just wanted, before we put the bill away, to have Ms. Stanfield explain what the genesis of the bill was, exactly what were the issues happening that makes this bill necessary, just in very real, concrete terms.
Brenda Stanfield, Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, to the chair. This bill was actually brought forward before we knew, so we weren't necessarily the impetus behind it, and it was that civil someone realizing they couldn't get protection without filing something civilly. The reason that the shelter programs, as reading this, got behind this is because it had been an ongoing issue that we could not figure out how to protect ourselves, and that we were struggling more and more with lack of law enforcement in a lot of locations. If there was law enforcement in a location, oftentimes they wouldn't be able to respond. Maybe they would have to send somebody to that location from quite a distance away. And so there had been no crime committed. They weren't, if you wanted them to trespass someone, they're not going to fly or drive hundreds of miles to give someone a trespassing warning, basically. And so there was really nothing done. This really came out of Emonic, and Emonic has just had a lot of problems in their small little community with getting someone to take serious the dangers that they have faced oftentimes each day, and routinely from the same individual for many, many years now, and very little to be done. And then since we have started talking about this, we have had situations come out of Anchorage. We've had situations happen in Bethel. We have situations talked about in Nome. So it really is out there.
So going off of Representative Costello's line of questioning earlier, if someone at the shelter, staying at the shelter, has a domestic violence protective order in place, well, then if the person's violating that protective order, an additional protective order isn't needed. But my understanding is that sometimes the person who's coming every day doesn't even know who's inside. And it really is the employees of the shelter who are like, we don't want this guy in our parking lot every day, and like, just being like a menacing presence. And so this would allow the institution basically to take out the protective order, because maybe the woman who had the protective order is no longer staying there, but he's still coming. Is that correct?
To the chair, that is correct. If there is a person staying at the shelter, most often when they go and get the protective order, it lists where they have to stay away from. And so if they know that they're living at the shelter, the courts will say you can't be within 500 feet, 1,000 feet, however far that is, within these locations. So maybe I'll just use she for purposes of talking, but maybe within her work and if she's living at the shelter and maybe the school. And so those will be lined out. And so in that situation, if you saw that person on the property or relatively close, absolutely you could call law enforcement and say, there, we know that there's an active protective order. They can't be within this. So we would not need to take out a separate order in those cases.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Mina.
Chair Gray, through the chair to the bill sponsor, I just would love a follow-up, maybe a supporting document that is a chart that compares the different protective orders between the emergency ex parte and then the long-term orders, and then what this new type of protect order would do, just to make sure that we compare those different eligibility and different parameters. Thank you.
Representative Mina, through the chair, absolutely, we'll get that to the committee.
Thank you. I guess my last thing to the sponsor is the more we've talked about it today, the more I think that the workplace protective order, we just had a presentation on protective orders on Monday, and we saw thousands for domestic violence, less for sexual assault, very few for stalking. I'm thinking that this is going to be what show up on the chart as very few. This is a very unusual and specific and rare circumstance that it's not going to, but I guess that's what I'm, my understanding from what we've heard today. Would you agree that this is not the type of protective order that would be filed thousands of times per year?
Representative Gray, that is my understanding, yes, that this is a sliver of a population meant to serve and protect shelter employers and employees.
Thank you for that, Representative Hall. I'll just say, though, that that's the part I think that some of us are kind of skirting around. It doesn't say anything about shelters in the bill. And so that's why I think we're kind of focusing on schools and this building, and, you know, because it does apply to all businesses. And so I think that might be one of the concerns that we have.
Chair Gray, I can understand where the committee is coming from and where that concern and kind of gray area and confusion is coming from, yes.
Representative Costello.
I just keep thinking, is there another way to approach this, perhaps under the stalking laws, we could have an aggravator is if it's at a shelter, so that just having unwanted people outside the shelter. But I do, you know, we have this situation arise where we have specific problems we're trying to address, yet once it's in statute, it applies to everybody. So I'm wondering if there is a way to go at this just from the shelter standpoint.
Thank you, Representative Costello. I hear exactly what you're saying. That's in line with my questions as well. So I think we will put the bill away. I also want to just say, in response to Representative Vance, in a non-joking way, I wonder about, like, who is our employer who would file a protect? Well, so Representative Mina said the people, but that wouldn't work. It would probably need to be the Speaker of the House for the House and the President of the Senate for the Senate. It's not spelled out in the bill, but that's what I'm thinking. And I'm thinking that that could get messy. So anyway, just things that I've thought about in this hearing. I appreciate the sponsor for bringing it forward. We will put House Bill 222 away and bring it back at a later date for public comment at that time. At ease. Back on the record, Our final item of business is HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment Relating to Corporations and Rights, sponsored by Representative Fields. At this time, I would like to invite Representative Fields staff, Michael Noti, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Could we actually take a break at ease?
At ease. Sorry. On the record, we will be not introducing HJR 31 today due to time constraints. We apologize to invited testifiers who've been waiting online for 4.5 hours, but we will be taking up this on another day. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here's our preview of upcoming meetings. On Friday, we will have a second hearing on House Bill 316, Adjust Damage Limits, Personal Injury, Wrongful Death by Representative Gray. HB 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks by Representative Moore. We will be having invited and public testimony on that bill. And then we will hear HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget by Representative Underwood. The time is now 4:38 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary is adjourned.